Hi, this is Steve Hargadon, and I'm with Audrey Waters. It's the 2nd of November 2012, and this is Hack Education, the podcast. Hi, Audrey.
Hello. We're not recording from the East Coast, as we were both initially planning.
We both feel very badly for those who have suffered in Hurricane Sandy, and we were both scheduled to be in New York this past week. And obviously yes. Couldn't go. Audrey, this was a really interesting week of posts. Not that many, but there's going to be some depth of conversation here, I think.
Mm-hmm.
The first one was, why is there an ed tech bubble, is the wrong question.
Yeah.
And we've talked plenty about this. It's not mm-hmm. as though we haven't explored this concern about revenue plans and the like, but you've taken us in a different direction here, and why don't you tell us about it?
Well, I was responding in part to a piece that Frank Catalano wrote, an op-ed that he wrote for the Seattle-based tech blog GeekWire, in which he sort of suggests that he's seeing the warning signs that there might be too much hype, too much investor hype, and too many entrepreneurs sort of cluelessly entering the space without really doing sort of building meaningful products. And I heard Fred Wilson respond when he was a guest in David Wiley's Ed Startup class about this. And this question of is there a bubble is something that the tech industry has been talking a lot about lately, just within its own economics, as we're seeing a great deal of investment and entrepreneurial activity just in tech in general. But I feel like when it comes to education, that this is the wrong, like if we're concerned about bubbles, which means when investors, anyone, it's not just a venture capitalist, but when someone's made an investment and what they're left holding isn't worth that investment any longer. I feel like that's really the wrong way for us to think about education. That's thinking about education in terms of its monetary value, which to me seems to be just the wrong thing to be chasing, both in terms of these startups that I'm seeing in ed tech, but really just in the way in which we want to be thinking about the future of technology and education.
So we get to use our red herring phrase again, right? I mean, mm-hmm. In some ways, what I think you're saying is this takes us down a path that ignores some really interesting other conversations around educational technology. So
right.
Yes, there may be an EdTech venture capital bubble,
mm-hmm.
but what we've seen in the last 5 years in terms of kind of prolific experimentation and peer learning and use of tools in tech tools in sort of reshaping thinking and learning. This is not something we should be not talking about just because we would say there's an edtech bubble, right?
Right, and I actually think that we don't want to only think about the innovation that's happening around use of these tools, development of these tools, adoption, implementation is something that only happens thanks to VC investment and that only happens under the leadership of entrepreneurs. I think that there's a lot of innovation that happens outside these monetary interests. There's a lot of innovation that happens by teachers. There's a lot of innovation that happens by students. And I think when we frame it in terms of ed tech bubble, of course the fear is always when the bubble bursts, then what? Right? What happens? Will funding dry up for startups? Will these startups go out of business? I think when we talk about ed tech in terms of financial bubbles, we're really ignoring some of the amazing things that are happening outside sort of those market-driven and market-oriented conversations.
So I had this conversation with Susie Boss, who's written a new book about innovation. And I said, you know, we've seen incredible innovation by educators in adopting social media tools and in thinking about technology in a way that really models what she's describing she hopes will happen in the classroom. And if the EdTech venture capital bubble bursts, it may reshape some of the tools that are available and the like, but I don't think it will have really any impact on that work that's being done.
No, I mean, I think you can sort of think about the ways in which some of these narratives, and we'll talk about this, I think, later with Paul Collins' narrative of the history of education, but some of these narratives play out and feed into other things as well. And I do think that we will continue to see new projects, new initiatives happen. But if we only identify what's innovative and new and exciting and transformative as something that happens once a venture capitalist invests $1 million or so, then I worry too that sort of feeds this notion that we can sort of throw up our hands and sort of surrender to the public, the end to the public funding of education, and the way of thinking of education as a public good, not as a private investment, not as a private investment for venture capitalists, but not as a private investment for an individual to make as well. I mean, I think, once we hand over the narrative to these money-oriented conversations, we lose a lot of what really matters.
If I think about my own experiences in education, the moments that seem to have the most weight and significance in thinking about how education takes place really revolve for me around ideas more than they do around products. Is that naive, or would you agree?
No, I think that's really important, and it's interesting because I'm, you know, as we sort of approach the end of the year, I've been thinking about some of my end of year wrap up posts and the trends that I want to identify that were important for 2012 and the education startups that I think were most interesting and innovative this year. And it's actually been really challenging for precisely this reason, because I think that a lot of the great things that I see happening, they actually fall out at the they aren't necessarily ed tech startups. They're tools that get tweaked and used for purposes of sharing and learning and collaborating and communicating, networking with others, but they aren't necessarily something that falls into the bucket of education technology, even though that's what they that's sort of what they get used for.
It's really hard not to dive into the mighty Khan's history of education at this point, so I won't go there. But as I was thinking about the things that he doesn't mention in the history of education, CMOOCs, connectivism, pedagogy, or peer learning,
right,
it occurred to me these are all ideas.
Yes.
The technology plays a role in helping bring the idea forth, and it can facilitate its use, but at core, it's an idea.
Well, and they're also, those what you just mentioned are all people, right? So this isn't just about part of the problem, I think, with how when we think of education even of itself as a product, whether the content is a product or the diploma is a product, we forget that ideas are born of people, and these connections between people, intellectual connections, mentorship connections, are something that you can certainly feel to put a price tag on that, but I think that there certainly are things that fall out. They sort of fall to the margin of some of these conversations when we are concerned about product, building products and building companies.
I think your core concern in the post is that we've lost the argument about educational technology if it's framed in the context of an ed tech bubble.
Yes.
Am I right?
Absolutely.
Okay, one of my favorite posts of yours of the year. Thank you for that. Okay, and I don't know that you really can call these new and noteworthy educational apps if you only used one app.
It's funny. I think I said this last month. Every month I do the series, I feature less and less. I get pickier and pickier. And part of it, you know, part of it I think is related to what I just said a few minutes ago, is that I actually, despite all of this exuberance and hype and activity among education technology entrepreneurs, I'm not all of that excited about the new products that I see, the new apps that I see each month. And so this month I only chose one, and it may well be that the series that I have reprised, goes dormant once again.
But you chose something really worth talking about. I was not familiar with Go-Go Games, but and you're going to have to tell us what pivotal response theory is, but this feels kind of stunning.
This is a really beautiful app. I mean, and it's beautiful in terms of its design, visual, the characters in it. It's beautiful in terms of how the gameplay. And I think it's beautiful in terms of sort of the depth of research and thought that went into building it. So I first met this startup, which is founded by three women who are Stanford grad students. I first met them this summer at the LTD Expo when they demoed this. And it's an iPad app that's been designed for autistic children, preschool and early elementary age children. And it's targeting this notion that one of the things that makes learning possible, sort of cognition possible, is that our minds learn how to focus on certain things, that we learn how to perceive things in certain ways, and so can tune out the noise to figure out, for example, why the letter E is different than the letter F. And according to researchers, autistic children seem to have a very difficult time with this sort of perceptual capability. And so the app is really designed around the sorts of therapy that an autistic child would have to help them learn these perceptual skills. So it's really taking the therapy that the autistic kids spend sort of hours and hours each week doing, and then building it into a game that is delightful and fun, and actually, according to research, that's how a lot of autistic children spend their sort of free time, is by playing video games. And the game is just incredibly thoughtfully designed. Everything from the sounds and the feedback, and in both cases sort of the lack thereof, really sort of taking away the things that would distract from the learning, and it's just a really beautifully, thoughtfully designed game. I can't say enough nice things about this startup. They've done really great work. I mean, I think a lot of people talk about the transformative power that the iPad in particular has been to autistic children, but if you look at a lot of the apps that are designed specifically for them, they're not that great looking, they're not that nice, they're not that beautiful, and I certainly don't think that they're as fun and engaging and as cheap as this one is.
I really want this to succeed. Even more than that, I'll look forward to the kind of research that will get done that would determine, you know, where in fact they're making a difference.
This is an interesting, thing too, I think, that ties into some of these conversations about what edtech startups are getting right and wrong, and why the bubble talk is the wrong dial for us to be tuning. This is an app, and it's a game that's research driven. It's research based. It's based on a theories of learning, and it's sort of. They've done a lot of work in schools in the Palo Alto area, working with autistic children and their families. They've had to go back to the drawing board a lot, but it's really a research driven and a scholarly endeavor. So So sort of all of the things that sometimes get dismissed as being, you know, too institutional, I think really can demonstrate that these are the things that can be incredibly powerful when used like this.
Terrific. Okay, so our friend at Instructure have entered the MOOC fray.
They have indeed.
So I don't think these are necessarily CMOOCs, are they?
No.
I guess the instructor could choose how they're going to hold it, but this is more kind of an XMOOC model, right?
I think it is more of an XMOOC model in some ways. I mean, I would say that one of the things about a CMOOC is that it would be unlikely to sort of have the learning management system be sort of the central component. A CMOOC, I think, is really much more about building networks and relationships distributed across learners' blogs and the like than it is what we think of traditionally as a learning management system. I think this is interesting. I'm not surprised to see Instructure make this move. Of course, Blackboard has its own sort of openly licensed, openly accessible MOOCs that it's been offering as well. So this isn't a surprise to see Instructure sort of get in on the action here. And I think in some ways, both cases, offer their LMS customers a way to test out open online courses without actually having to sort of sign over the farm to Coursera.
Again, full disclosure, I've done consulting work for Instructure. I'm not currently now. But I like them as a company, and I'm anxious to see sort of where this goes. So 12 universities, 24 courses. What's the benefit model here? Is it a pain test? Is it a value test? What will be success here, and why would people do it?
I think that, you know, as you look at sort of the universities that are clamoring to join Coursera, and I think some of the conversations that campuses across the country are having about how are they going to respond to MOOCs, I think that there's this notion that you want to have that MOOCs are the hot new thing in higher ed, and to have your university, it's a bit like that fear of missing out argument I made, to have your university not participate sort of looks bad. And I think to have your university participate is sort of marketing, it's good marketing for your university. You look like a forward-thinking, tech-oriented, cutting-edge university. And so I do think that in most of these cases, and in fact, it sounded when I talked to Josh Coates, the CEO, it sounded like that was the sell that Instructure was giving to universities, was that this is a way for you to market your university, take a class that you already have offered, and just sort of flip the settings so that anybody with internet access can sign up and participate.
Part of what makes Instructure so fascinating is the body of educators and students who are all in the framework, right? I mean, there's an excitement about connecting with other people across institutions. There's the potential for interesting ways of grouping people and helping them connect with each other and research and the like. I also kind of get the feeling as though this is the perfect medium in which for people to try this. Not very expensive. They're already signed up with Instructure. They can play around with it. And when the MOOC bubble bursts, the people who've been involved with Instructure won't necessarily have, won't lose all of this investment. I'm going on a limb there, but.
No, I think that's actually really important, and they won't have outsourced things to any more than you already are doing a certain amount of outsourcing when you pay for a learning management system, for a third-party learning management system. But they want to have outsourced a lot of the expertise around instructional design, around the processes of offering online education to another institution. I mean, all of it, or it's not to another institution, to a third-party provider. All that Instructure is really offering here is what these universities already get, which is a learning management system. So Instructure isn't doing robo-grading. Instructure isn't videotaping lectures for them. Instructure isn't doing the sorts of things that Coursera, for example, does for the professors in the classes that it offers on its platform. So universities themselves get to retain the intellectual property, they get to retain the staffing expertise on site with how to handle a move to online education, which I think is really, really important to not just outsource all of this to a for-profit company.
What about course credit?
I don't think that there's any of these classes. I'm not sure. I haven't signed up for any of these yet. Although the one class on gender through comic books that will be with the lectures narrated by Stan Lee sounds a little bit appealing. But I don't know that. I mean, I think that these are classes that are offered on campus, so there might be opportunities for local and enrolled students to get credit. But there isn't any conversation at this point about how to get how open enrollees would get credit.
How many institutions does Instructure work with? Do we know?
I don't recall offhand. I think that they said the statistic that sits in my brain from my conversation with Josh was that they have 4.5 million students and faculty using the platform now. But I don't recall how many institutions. A couple of hundreds, I think.
So it seems like they might be brilliantly positioned to manage the credit piece.
I don't know. I mean, I think that they're brilliantly positioned to handle the learning management piece. I mean, and this is one of those things that's really struck me having taken both Udacity and Coursera classes. I really just sort of put my head in at edX. I haven't really taken any of the classes, but what all three of those are doing is sort of reinventing the learning management system and reinventing it in ways that clearly haven't been listening to any of the things that students and faculty say about why they hate, not to pick on the company that we all pick on, but why they hate Blackboard. The learning management system that Coursera has built is not very user-friendly. And I think that that's the thing that you hear from students and faculty alike, that they really do like Instructure in terms of a platform to use to house the sort of online component of their schoolwork. So I think that Instructure is well positioned on that side. I don't know about the credit piece. I think that that seems a lot more complicated.
We'll save that for another day. Okay, because we don't want to miss out on a robust discussion about 11 minutes of history of education given by none other than Saul Khan, who places himself at the pinnacle of that history.
I couldn't, like, I saw, like, this, I saw a link to this YouTube video, 11 minutes of the history of education, and I thought, well, this is going to be really bad. And I was right. It's the story that Saul Khan paints of the history of the United States, I should say, primarily in the United States, with this strange appearance by the Prussians. I was appalled that this would be promoted as being anything, any sort of historical item, and a good reminder of why people say nice things about his math and physics videos, but tend not to say great things about how Saul Khan teaches history.
Well, I mean, to be fair, we all tell different histories of education, right? It's part of our own
True.
narrative as we're talking, and probably could do so in 11 minutes. And it may not be fair to be seeing this as the be all and end all of Saul's thinking about education, but it does occur to me that I don't see Khan Academy or the video online lecture as actually being a significant change. It clarified that for me, right? Like if I look at what Nicholas Negroponte is doing with giving students computers or tablets without any instruction, right? Or Howard Rheingold talking about peer learning, or Sugata Mitra with the hole in the wall or the kiosks, or George Siemens and the gang, on CMOOCs and connectivism. Those feel to me like real changes. Am I just being too critical? But I don't see Khan Academy as actually being a significant moment in time.
I mean, I think that, I think that it certainly builds on a number of pieces. I would say that in one hand, it certainly builds on the explosion of user-generated video content on YouTube, which I think is interesting for teaching and learning in ways that are far more diverse than just Saul Khan's videos. I think about kids making, there's a great video that Dean Sharesky often shows when he was learning to play the guitar, that someone made a video responding, Dean made a video of himself playing the guitar, and a teenager made a video response and showed sort of some corrections to fingering. And I do think that there's interesting potential around user-generated video content. But no, I don't think that this the headline, in fact, Saul Khan's on the headline or on the front cover of the latest Forbes magazine, and it's the revolution as being as portrayed there is this notion of one person can now teach millions of people, and to me that's still, I mean, we talked about this before, that's still a content delivery model that's not necessarily that different than one textbook being shipped to millions of classrooms around the country.
And I think you're right. I mean, I think I actually probably would say I think YouTube will be a significant part of our thinking about how education changed, but not because of mass delivery. In the same way that I
Right.
don't think that ex-MOOCs are going to be long-term considered a big shift in education. You mentioned a number of things that don't get discussed in his history. And there's some pushback in the comments that, in fact, those things that you mentioned aren't really significant changes to the kind of seat time, cohort banded model that Saul's describing from 18, whatever it was, till now. Have you thought about what are the core things that you think he didn't address that really have been significant moments?
Well, I mean, I would say, I mean, to me, I think to say that 18, I mean, in the course of his history, he skips from 1892, which was when the Committee of Ten met to decide sort of what the shape, what the face of public education would look like in terms of compulsory education, 12 years of compulsory education. He really skips from there to the advent of Khan Academy, which is a pretty big leap, and I think it and says nothing has changed. And I do think that the changing faces of students who have access to education, what that access looks like, and what the purpose of education is, does change all of those things. Even if it doesn't disrupt the cohort model, to say that education hasn't changed is, I mean, it's pretty ludicrous, because I do think that the purpose of education has certainly changed. And to me, the missing piece in when you skip over 120 years is that you skip over progressive education. You skip over John Dewey, you skip over Maria Montessori, you skip over Booker T. Washington. You skip over people who had a very different vision from some of these things that, from, quote, this factory model, who made arguments for, for the whole child, for project-based learning, for education as being about equity and civics and responsibility to the community. And so I think that to erase those voices, I think, is terrible. And it actually does a disservice to the people who have, I think, fought hard and created a different vision, whether or not it's survived en masse or not, but who created a very different vision of what it would mean to educate every child in this country.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I agree and also see that, I would have put homeschooling in there as another movement. But if the goal was to tell a particular version of history in order to kind of define the moment for Khan Academy, I could see the justification for skipping over movements that haven't sort of really altered the sense.
Right. You can't tell. Right? You can't just.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean that's
well,
the thing.
You can't tell the stories
that
don't match with your own.
Right. I mean, he could.
Go ahead.
You can't justify Khan Academy as being this revolutionary, transformative moment in terms of delivering content to millions of students if you include John Dewey and project-based learning, because that, like project-based learning, progressive education. And that way of thinking about school doesn't fit either into the kinds of schooling that Khan Academy says that he's going to be able to unlock by having children watch videos and answer multiple choice questions.
So this is a good lesson for me, because I probably would have told this story differently. I might have told the story of the Committee of Ten, but who was actually attending higher education at that time, and who was even attending secondary school. And then I would talk about kind of the mass numbers of people who come into public education and the ways in which that doesn't fit for them. And I could see myself creating my own simplified version of public education to justify the things that I'm working on. So this story was easy to criticize Saul, but also gave me some pause to think about the complexities of the topic and to make sure I don't step into that same bear trap.
But I think that's one of the things, though, that I wanted to stress, is that when we tell history, we always do that. I mean, this isn't just a case of a revisionist history, although I think that there's definitely some pretty important slippage in the story that Saul Khan has told, least of which, putting himself as the pinnacle of things of education. But I think that when we talk about the history of history, and we collect together a story of events, and we narrate that with some sort of there's some sort of analytical thrust that moves history forward, we always do that with a particular bent in mind, with a particular goal of what we want that history to highlight. And so I don't think it's surprising that the history of education, according to Saul Khan, highlights Saul Khan. History always does that. But I think that as I hear so many EdTech entrepreneurs, so many folks in Silicon Valley also tell this story that education hasn't changed for hundreds of years until they came along just this year now. To me, I want to unpack what are the ramifications of that story, and whose stories aren't being told by that. And I think, we're seeing all sorts of people get left out. I think that, the story of MOOCs that are being told right now, the New York Times has a 5,000-word story today on MOOCs and doesn't mention Siemens or Downs or Corning once, doesn't mention that there was anything before Sebastian's run. I think that that's important, and we should pay better attention to our history, because I do think it shapes how we see the future.
Shall we move on to the news?
Yep, let's move on.
So, Hurricane Sandy, obviously, many of us have been sort of deeply interested and concerned about what's taking place there. You talk about Twitter giving its promoted tweets functionality to relief agencies for free, but Facebook still required users of its pages to pay. I don't really know what that means or how pages works, but is there a larger lesson for us?
I think that there is. I mean, if you like a page on Facebook, the way in which Facebook works now is that if you want the post that page makes to reach more than 5% of your fans, you have to pay them. And so I think it's food for thought, particularly for schools that are recognizing sort of the power of social media and are using tools like Facebook to sort of get the word out, for parents and students about whether it's activities or, various after-school activities or things like that Facebook, that sort of the marketing interests of Facebook don't necessarily dovetail well with the community efforts of using the tool. And I think it was particularly important when we're dealing with a crisis situation in which you want to get the messages out to everyone by any means necessary, that this, this great new tool that we have at our disposal through social media isn't, for Facebook at least, it's not so great.
Interesting. More sort of difficult news out of Penn State, the former president now facing numerous charges.
Difficult, but I don't
are
think
there,
surprising. I mean, I think that sort of...
No, I don't...
Yeah, once the FBI, or sorry, not FBI, once Louis Freeh, who's formerly FBI director, when his report came out about sort of the cover-up that the administration at Penn State had sort of engaged in order to make sure that not just that no one knew what Jerry Sandusky was doing, but to sort of continue to allow him to sort of perpetuate these crimes against children, I don't think anyone's surprised to see the legal fallout from that.
Are there some larger lessons here? I mean, I don't want to dwell too much on this or make too much of it, but it does feel as though there's this sort of continued lesson about money and what drives, when we think about what would drive an institution of higher education and the sports programs. But there's also this sort of deep lesson about the degree to which perceptions, willingness to look the other way, a willingness to go along with certain ideas are related to money.
Yeah,
and
I think
does it give us at least a little bit of a foothold to talk about higher ed and money?
I think so, and I think that I think it's particularly evident around this particular university for whom it continues to be, even with the fines that were levied against it by the NCAA, it continues to be so closely identified with the football team. And so I do think that sort of the lengths to which schools go in order to support sort of one arm of their future, perhaps the most public outward facing beloved part of their identity. I think it will be interesting to see, particularly with these discussions about the future of higher ed, what many campuses decide will be that piece that they would be willing to protect, and when do administrators go behind closed doors to protect that?
Which is not a bad segue into Coursera and Antioch University, right? Yeah. Which is, you would think that the actual courses would be the thing you would protect, but when the universities license courses from Coursera that are for credit, that does feel a little bizarre to me.
This is a very interesting deal, and I don't. I mean, and I don't know. It's still so early in all of this. I don't know if this is going to be the way forward in terms of the business model for Coursera, and I don't know what that means in terms of a business model for the participating universities either, for the universities that are licensing content to get credits on their campus, or the universities that have signed deals with Coursera, who are finding their courses offered and given for credit elsewhere either. But I think that it's a very interesting development. And the other piece of that is sort of how do the professors' labor factor into this too?
Okay, we have a big election coming up.
We do.
And
yay.
We don't have to spend much time on this, but I am curious about your take on kind of what I would call a catch. What's that? Am I delayed?
Yep. It's caught up now.
Now that I'm going through my cell internet, I'm guessing I'm getting delayed. Okay, so I'm interested in the kind of what seems to me to be a little bit of a catch-22. So we define education as high-stakes testing and training. That doesn't allow for really good sort of high-level thinking about issues and topics. So we have sort of low-level thinking that leads to low-level discussions, which then leads to unfortunately, a high-level impact of lobbyists versus sort of national dialogue on issues. I mean, you and I have talked about sort of the debates between the two main candidates and how little of what I actually really cared about was discussed in those debates. Is it too simplistic to point a finger to our paradigm for education as being a significant part of our inability to think or talk at a reasonably high level about
I think this is really one of the most sort of to me it sort of gets to the core of the stakes that we have right now in talking about what we want the future, what we want education, schooling, the future of schools, whether it's K-12 or higher ed, what we want them to look like, and what we expect that process of having students participate, having children participate in school, having adults participate in college, what we want to gain from that. It does feel as though the more that we've gone down this path towards sort of high stakes standardized testing, that we seem to have at the very same time lost our ability to have creative, critical thinking, problem-solving skills that we are optimizing for absolutely the wrong thing, right when more than, well, I don't know if about more than ever, I suppose any moment would be this, but right when it does seem incredibly important that we are able to have thoughtful and nuanced and difficult, really, really difficult discussions about the future, whether that's the future in environmental factors or in terms of equity, in terms of our responsibility to one another or to the planet, to other countries. It does seem like we are unable to have these discussions, the grown-ups, let alone future generations.
Okay, so Pew released a study about students and their research online. Among the results, 65% of teachers agreed that the internet makes students more self-sufficient researchers.
I was actually sort of disappointed
by
this research by Pew. I think, I like reading the research that they've done, but this one seemed to me to be a little odd. They only worked with AP classes, which... So that's a specific subset of students who take AP classes. And then they asked, it was really about the teachers' assessments of how students were researching, not necessarily the students' own assessments of how they were researching. And so I was a little disappointed by the way in which they sort of formulated this study.
Is this at all related to the research the New York Times reported on that related to how technology is changing attention?
Oh, I saw the headline.
Frustrations the teachers are having.
Thank you, Matt Richtel, for bringing the New York Times into 2012. The one that was technology may change how we learn, and I bookmarked that to read later.
Well, that article talks about, it says one of the research projects was that focused on technology-related
Maybe.
Research. So I think this story came out of that directly. We may save this for another conversation, but it occurred to me that there is this sort of surface-level story of students being harder to control and not paying attention and being more distracted. And there's a deeper story that I think doesn't get addressed, which I wonder if it's not actually playing a more significant role, and that is a shift in youth's willingness to be participating in control and compliance
mm-hmm.
Environments when the tools of technology allow them so much independence elsewhere. You can decide if you want to talk on that at all, but I'm curious about that because it feels like that gets ignored. And I know, at least for me, with my own children, there is a distraction
right.
issue in the same way that there is with television. But I also think they're manifesting a level of independence by virtue of what they can do with these tools
that just didn't exist when
I was
always,
that age.
It does intrigue me about some of these conversations. Even back to the things that Paul Collin gets sort of credited for, is this notion that kids recognize now that, particularly through the internet, that there's such a wealth of things for them to learn about, and that they can learn about the things that really matter to them. And they do so in ways that feel authentic. So, in the case of Dean Shores keep playing the guitar, there are lots of kids that, in order to learn to play the guitar, they decide that they have a musical interest, and they turn to YouTube, they turn to the internet for lessons. So I think that sort of freedom to explore what interests you, to learn about things that interest you, and to really have a wealth of resources at your fingertips that you can navigate under your own steam in a different way than navigating the library feels like research to learn things. I think that makes some of the drudgery of schoolwork seem even all the more inauthentic to them. And so I think that these are the sort of the conflicts that we see right now with a lack of attention, because it doesn't matter. I think the students know it doesn't matter.
I love how you've described that. You did a better job than I did.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that's not the whole story, and it may be in some ways a little bit of a glamorization right. of the role of the technology, but it does occur to me that some of what I see as being kind of a knee-jerk reaction of kids not paying attention is
mm-hmm.
actually kids manifesting their independence and like you've just said, knowing that they have
right.
a very different experience outside of school than they do in school. Okay, so you and I are really in good shape now because George Lucas sold Lucasfilms to Disney, and he's planned to donate most of that money to
Me
education
too.
Philanthropy.
Me too,
and
yeah.
I'm waiting for the check.
This was interesting. I thought that this was a really interesting piece of sort of popular culture news, but also an interesting thing, thinking about the entertainment industry, technology, story as well. Sort of what is the Star Wars franchise, I suppose, and the Indiana Jones franchise, movies that I really adored growing up. What is it worth nowadays, and what is it worth to Disney? And I think I will be interested to see what Lucas does with his $4 billion. He was the full owner of Lucasfilm, so that money is his. He says he'll spend it on education. And, of course, you know, the George Lucas Foundation runs Edutopia. So I guess we'll see. We'll see if Lucas's notion of education philanthropy is different than Bill Gates' notion of education philanthropy. I think even though Lucas sits at the head of Edutopia, it doesn't feel anything like the sort of agenda-driven policies or the agenda-driven philanthropy that we see coming from the Gates Foundation. But maybe with $4 billion that'll change.
Very interesting. Can't wait to hear where that goes. Also talking about big money, according to Business Insider, Google's biggest advertiser is the University of Phoenix, spending a stunning $155,000 a day on ads in the third quarter.
I think that this is one of the things that the for-profit universities like University of Phoenix has been blasted for, is that they spend they spend all this money on marketing and then very little on actual sort of student support. And I was actually shocked to hear that this was Google's number one advertiser.
I want to be careful here. I mean, I did interview, what's her name, from Phoenix, University of Phoenix. Her name escapes me. But I mean, they're acting as a business. They're spending advertising money where it's going to get a return. I mean, I don't think you can fault an organization necessarily for advertising in a way that produces a return. I'm just more concerned about the whole model of education, in which we see the market is the solution. So we hear this a lot. It came up with Governor Romney related to FEMA, in a great moment of misfortune for him in terms of timing, right? But when I hear someone like Governor Romney say, we need to turn this over to the market, even before Hurricane Sandy, that just doesn't make sense to me, right? There are some things that we say, that's something that the market can handle. And there are other things we say, that's not really something that should be, like, I don't think prisons should be something that are commercially provided. I think it creates the wrong incentive and perversely creates an incentive for keeping more people in prison. And we've seen the results of that. So I'm not necessarily sure I want to find too much fault with the University of Phoenix necessarily, although that might be easy. But it just raised the issue for me. That's just an enormous amount of money for advertising.
Well, and to me, I thought of this too in terms of that Pew study on how students are researching online. And to me, it's sort of if the University of Phoenix is Google's largest, if they're spending more money on Google Ads than anyone else, it's because there's an awful lot of education-related searches being conducted. And, of course, University of Phoenix wants their name to surface when you search for things. And so, to me, it's sort of also a testament to sort of the great potential for the web to become this new tool used for search, for research, for learning, but then sort of at what cost, when the way in which we support that is something that's sucking public money into an endeavor that leaves students, with a mediocre degree and a lot of student debt, or if they're lucky, a degree and then a great amount of student debt.
So, if you take $155,000 a day and you multiply it by 365 days in a year, it turns out to be about $56.5 million a year. Right, which seems like an enormous amount of money to be spending on advertising. I have no idea what University of Phoenix gross revenues are. But that is a drop in the bucket compared to $1.37 billion that education startups have received. And if you assume that the money that an education startup receives has to be multiplied somefold in terms of a return, you're talking about even bigger numbers, right, for revenue potential. So now we're getting into really big numbers and the expectations. And again, without my senses, I'm not seeing really strong revenue strategies. Maybe University of Phoenix is one. But for these ed startups, is there is there enough revenue strategy to cover, $10 billion in revenue to make up for the
And I would add the piece of accounting, and I don't know that it's necessarily a zero sum game, but the other piece of accounting that fits in here, and I say this as well, is we're seeing the public funding for education, the amount of money that states are giving to universities, for example, on the decline. And so certainly I wonder if it feels as though we're seeing all of this sort of exuberance for education companies and little interest in committing to educate. So we're seeing excitement for individual investment, private companies, little excitement for public responsibility to public institutions. And so, I think, I don't want to have a conversation that's just about financials around this. But I do think how these things are getting shaped certainly dictates the way in which we're going to see education in the future. Is it a public good, or is it an investment for someone, the individual or the VC, to capitalize on, and how?
Mm-hmm. So if we come back to the beginning of the podcast, then maybe a way to couch this would be to say, it seems very likely that it's going to be hard to find that kind of revenue in ways that are positive or
right.
Maybe even possible in education. So it seems likely that there is an ed tech venture capital bubble and it's going to burst. And when it does, then your message is, let's be really mm-hmm. careful not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And remember that education is not about the financial win. It's about the ideas that we have and the ways that we commit to education. And let's, if and when this bubble bursts,
absolutely.
Let's not lose steam and let's, doing good
yeah,
things.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that let's be mindful, too. I think that this is, let's be mindful, again, thinking about Saul Kahn's history of public education in this country. So, let's be mindful about what our responsibilities are to beyond just the economic responsibilities of turning out workers, but what are our responsibilities to our communities? What are our responsibilities to other people's children? What are our responsibilities to the future, to the greater good, to the public good? And don't just reduce this idea of education down to how do I get enough credentials or enough training so that I can be financially successful.
Audrey, thanks for a really thought-provoking week of writing.
Talk to you next week.
Have a great week, everybody.